This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
What's up, NBA fans? It's Danny Green here. For those who want an inside look at the league through the eyes of a three-time champion, check out my podcast, Inside the Green Room. New episodes drop every week. Be sure to subscribe to Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're going to talk to Rick Pitino here in just a minute or two. Head coach of the first place of the Big East, St. John's Red Storm, 22-4, having such a resurgent, spectacular season. And you can see in depth that season with Red Storm Rising on Vice TV. St. John's men's basketball team has given Vice TV backstage access to document their season. In Rick Pitino's second year coaching the team, the six-part documentary series is titled Pitino, Red Storm Rising, and airs every Tuesday night at 10 p.m. on Vice TV. The second episode premieres tonight, and CeeLo played a cut from the first episode of Coach Pitino getting into the players at halftime of the Providence game, and the coach joins us now. Rick, good morning. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Well, thanks for having me, guys. I'm great.
So we just heard the halftime speech at Providence. You guys are down 12, and you got into those guys. And I'm sitting here next to Willie Colon, who played for some great head coaches, and people yelling at him. And we're sitting here smiling. Maybe we're a little old school, but you know, like it's you got to really know your guys, I think, in 2025 to get into them like that and not lose them. Why did you know that that approach was going to work with this particular group?
Well, really wasn't that tough on him. You should have seen some of my Kentucky halftimes. But you know, look, you watch Bill Parcells, a fabulous coach on the sidelines. You can't do that today. And the difference is as long as you don't personalize it toward an individual, you can get on them hard. As long as it's always toward the team, you know, most of them will say, hell, that's not me he's talking to, you know. So, you know, as long as you don't personalize it, they will respond. And we've had some very difficult halftimes this year because we're down probably most halftimes that we play this year. And the problem I have with this basketball team is, okay, they're a little bit challenging at the offensive end, is they deflate all the time when they miss shots, and they let it affect the rest of their game. And I keep telling them, just keep shooting. You're taking good shots. Don't worry about the misses. Just be concerned. And I always preach to them that, look, you're 0 for 4 from 3. If you make the next 4, you're shooting 50%. So just get on to the next shot. That's a good one. And that's what I try to preach with them. But early in the year, because we're all getting to know each other because of this transfer portal, new people coming in, they're all learning me. I'm learning them. And as long as you don't go after the individual, you can get after them as much as you want in a positive way. And they responded. They came back from basically just a horrible half to win it at the buzzer.
You talk about learning, Coach. You guys had a gritty win over Creighton. What do you think your team learned from that one?
You know, I think you learn from every game, certainly. We're starting to shoot the ball better. I told them before the game, I said, look, guys, I'm not surprised you're in first place, but I am surprised that the Garden is selling out, not a seat to be had. Everybody's behind you now, and you have done this. Your work ethic much like the New York Knicks last year with that New York strong attitude and that just that incredible work ethic. I said, you're bringing the fans back and you deserve all the credit, and go out there tonight and show them why they're here. And they did. They responded in a very positive way against a very well-coached Creighton team.
And I grew up on St. John's basketball. My mom graduated from there in the 60s. She took me to Boo Harvey Senior Day. I pretended to be Zendon Hamilton in my driveway. And I've been to many games with her and seen some of the down years. And to watch this has been great so far. But you know, you've been to the top of the mountain many times. And you see in the garden the way that it is and the resurgence of this program. Are you able to enjoy it in this moment, or are you still thinking about the job still needs to be done and we got to take this thing further?
Well, there are so many things with the job between the lines, away from the lines, that have to be accomplished at St. John's, because it's been a dormant program from a facility standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, for almost 25 years. It's a time warp. I think if you travel to Cuba right now, you would see the same thing with St. John's basketball in terms of nothing being done for 25 years to market the product. Because you had a legendary coach with Lou Carnesecca, who just brought in all these great New Yorkers, and everybody followed it. And Louis had the magic wand with that. But today, it's a different ballgame. And I know Louis's looking down at us with great pride, because we're accomplishing so many things away from the lines, between the lines. And it still has to grow for you to build a program. You know, we're building a season right now, but it's not a program yet.
How do you keep these guys in the fight, Coach? I know you got DePaul tomorrow night, and obviously you got Marquette and UConn down the road. You can't take a step backward. You talk about building momentum. How do you do that right now?
Well, you're right. The DePaul game, there'll be very few people there. There'll be a couple thousand people there. And it's you know, St. John's, Connecticut went into Seton Hall. Seton Hall's in last place, and they lost. And it can happen to all of us on any given night if you don't bring your A game, so, especially when you're in first place. I mean, DePaul would do anything to knock off a first-place team. So we're going to be highly motivated for this game. I tell them, I've already told them, that DePaul is much more important than Creighton, Connecticut, or Marquette. And they look at me a little strange. I said, well, if you lose to one of those teams, you're going to probably drop a few in the polls. You're going to probably drop a few spots in the net. But if you lose to DePaul, you're going to really crash in the net and the polls. So they understand what's at stake. They're a good group as far as that's concerned. They bring it. My only complaint with them is deflating when they miss shots. Zuby does it when he misses a free throw, and he's the greatest character we have on our team. So just getting them over that hump, it's taken a while. I think they're over it right now, and that's exciting to see.
Boomer and Geo with Rick Pitino, St. John's men's head basketball coach on the Fan and CBS Sports Network. Episode 2 of Pitino Red Storm Rising tonight, debuting at 10 p.m. on Vice TV. Now, when I first heard of the Davon Smith injury, I was devastated to hear, knowing how important he is to the team. And it seemed like you were just as shocked as everybody else to see him come back so soon and have the impact that he did against Creighton. Where's your confidence level in his health going forward?
Well, as you know, with injuries, sometimes getting over them is a psychological thing, even more so than a physical thing. And Davon was struggling. He got hit very hard in the shoulder. It's the same shoulder he had trouble with in the summertime. And I just said to the trainers, look, we need to shut him down. The doctor said the same thing. They said, no, he can play. And I said, no, psychologically, he's not there. Then the next day, he went to a player development session. He said, Coach, I'm ready to go. This team needs me. And I was as shocked as anybody. The coach of Creighton said at his press conference, that would be the last time I listened to a word Pitino says. and I meant it. I was going to shut him down for 3 or 4 games. And sure enough, he came out. And without him, we don't beat Creighton. So that was a blessing.
You talked about the production of Davion Smith, but how about R.J. Lewis? We had 23 points the other night. Can you talk about his production on the team?
Yeah, R.J.'s having a great season. He's having, a player of the year season. And here's the fascinating thing about R.J. He's not close to his potential. Mm. R.J. can get so much better at so many different things. And that's the great thing about RJ. He's got so much room for growth. And if this is going to sound a little strange to you guys, but even Kadari Richmond is getting better and better with each game and each practice. And, you know, it's the old thing, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. It's just absolutely not true with basketball. I mean, Kadari is learning, growing, getting better, and it's exciting to see. I'm really, really fired up the way he's playing as well as RJ.
How much do you buy into some of the old tournament adages about what team wins in that type of environment? Because the ones who want to knock the St. John's fans down are saying, well, you know, you can't hit threes. And when you get into the tournament, if you're not hitting those threes, you're not going to be able to move on. And then I have to fight back and talk about the defense and the heart and all of the things. And so do you buy into those old tournament adages, or every year is different with every team?
So I went in 2005, we went to a Final Four, and I had 6.5 players. The half player had a stress fracture, couldn't practice. We played 2-3 zone. It was a great offensive shooting team. Great. Francisco Garcia, Tyquan Dean, Larry O'Bannon. Awesome shooting team. But defensively, they were playing 2-3 zone, sitting back, hoping the other team misses. And then in 2013, we won a national championship with a great defensive pressing team. So we have enough offensive firepower to win it. Now, I do worry about the free throw shooting. I don't worry about the three-point shooting. I worry about the free throw shooting because that's a psychological thing. Zuby's a good free throw shooter, and the other, because he missed the first couple, it got to him. And that's where you have to win close games in the NCAA tournament. You have to make free throws. And it's just going to be something I have to do at the end of the game. I've got to get the best shooters, free throw shooters, in the game to make sure if we're in the bonus.
How do you prepare this team to be physical? I know Sunday between Creighton, the two teams have 42 fouls between them. You guys have shown that you guys are gritty, tough, and physical. How do you keep that going, especially as the season starts to wrap up?
You know, you always look at the strengths and weaknesses, obviously, with Gio and some of the people pointing out the weaknesses. But the strengths are this team is physically tough. They don't quit. They played one bad defensive game the whole year, and that was Villanova. And they own up to it right away. They said, "Coach, it's not going to happen again." So they know where their bread is buttered. They know what they have to do to win. That doesn't mean they can't get beat. Any team in the Big East could beat us, but we're capable of beating any team in the Big East as well as the country. And I'm a very confident person right now with the people that we're coaching because they give it to us all the time. And that's a great trait. You know, you guys, I show them constant Instagram things on Kobe Bryant, the Mamba mentality. I'm a gigantic believer in the Mamba mentality. And if you listen to Kobe speak, I send that to him all the time. If I capture any words of Kobe, I send it to him right away.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that really just rings in the future still with Kobe having tragically been gone. I mean, that is something that's going to live on forever. So I found it interesting as we talked to Rick Pitino that you felt the need to take to social media and talk to the fans about the John Calipari return to Rupp Arena and how much you had an experience that was memorable in a negative way, and you wanted to make sure that John didn't have that same thing. So that was really important to you to put that out there, it seems.
Yeah, I thought about it. I said, first I said, mind your own business. And then I thought about it. I said, you know what? When I walked into I loved the University of Kentucky, absolutely loved it. I called it Camelot for me. I never had a bad day there, even when I took over the program, which was on probation. And when I went in there as a Louisville coach and had 24,000 people booing me, it was really, really difficult. It hit my emotions. Today, I understood why. You know, it's a Louisville coach. It's the Jet coach walking into a giant stadium or vice versa. So I understand it, but it still hurt. So I just put that out there and hoping that I could get to 20% of the fans just to cheer someone who won a national championship for them. But I think John withstood it very well because they won the game.
Yeah.
And I think he would rather get booed and win the game than get applauded and lose the game.
Yeah, I mean, you can't keep anybody happy. I mean, actually, no, you can keep... The St. John's fan is a really happy fan right now. But, I mean, I feel like the rest of the fans...
Out the Garden.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's a very happy fan. But generally, fans are not that happy. All right, so talk to me about the cameras following you. I mean, obviously, you're no stranger to a lot of media attention throughout your career. But this is like a crew that's following you, you know, started before the season. There were some people that thought that this started once you guys were starting to have a great season. No, this was something that started before the season. So what's that experience been like behind the scenes?
So I did it for twofold reasons. One, St. John's needed to be marketed. You know, it's we've lost a generation of fans between like 25 and 45. So we lost them. We need to get them back. We need to market our product. We're in the greatest city in the world, but has 10 pro teams. We're the 11th pro team. So we had, so Vice is helping us market the product. They also gave us a nice stipend for NIL use. And so that helps as well. But anything I can do, if I meet somebody on a street corner in New York City walking around, I say, come on, catch a Johnny all season long. They said, they're yelling, go Johnny. I said, you coming to the game? They said, oh, we'd love to. I said, come on, bring your friends. So I'm trying to cultivate them one by one. And anything I can do to market the product of St. John's basketball, I will do.
I mean, you're spot on, Coach. Like, I grew up watching Filippo Lopez and Eric Barkley and Postel, and you talk about Hamilton and all those guys. Like, that was Johnny basketball to me. Now it's a new era. Coach, how, I mean, you talk about social media. Like, one of the, I want to say cringeworthy things, but I see these coaches in the SEC, they're doing the nay-nay. They're doing all these things on social media. Are you comfortable on social media more than ever because you have to be solely because of marketing?
Yeah, I think it's not easy for a 72-year-old to be on social media. but, you know, the one thing I do is I tweet a lot. Anything that's positive, I tweet out. And my son tweets it out for me, who lives in Tampa, Florida. So I never read what's coming back. So Twitter, as you know, could be a cesspool at times. So my son gets stuck reading all the opposite fans killing me. But I do get into social media because it is part of marketing. And you have to really, everything you do today, just what I said in the beginning, that you can, as long as you don't personalize. When I want to get on a player individually, I'm very calm, and I bring him in my office. And I show him exactly what he's doing. One of my pet peeves is, I have a few guys. RJ is one of them. Zuby's another. Actually, half my team. When they get fouled and the referee doesn't call it, they motion to the referee, and it takes about 2 or 3 seconds away from him getting back in transition defense. And I keep telling them and harping on it, I've been in the game 50 years. The referee is not going to change the call by you trying to embarrass him that you got fouled. If anything, you're not going to get the call. Now, here's what you need to do. The first dead ball, you need to go up to ref. Hey, ref, they fouled me pretty hard on the last play. Could you just please watch it going forward? Then you may get the next call. But if you stand there with your arms open trying to embarrass that ref, you are not getting the next call. So it's one of my pet peeves with them. And we're getting better at it, but we're still not doing it. Now, Kadari never does it. Kadari understands the game.
Number 10 ranks St. John's. The six-part documentary is titled Patino Red Storm Rising. Tuesday night is when they debut. So tonight, the second episode at 10 p.m. on Vice TV. Rick, when this season's over and the weather warms up, it's me, you, Boomer, Mike Kenny at Sleepy Hollow. Okay, we're going to lock that in.
Or Wingfoot, because I, you know, Wingfoot would be great as well.
All right, perfect. Yeah, I'm not going to complain.
Yeah.
All right, take care, Rick. Best of luck against the poll and going forward.
Thanks for having me, guys. Take care.
All right.
We got a special guest in studio, Johnny Franco. Man, I love this song. It brings me back to the Shea Stadium days, Johnny.
Me too.
Johnny boy.
You listen to this like you're driving around the city or whatever, and like, yeah, this is my song back in the day.
Yeah, once in a while. I listen to you guys when I'm driving down to Philly.
Do you listen to us?
Yeah, my daughter goes to Penn, so I drive down and have lunch with us. I listen to you guys all the time.
All Ivy League kids? Because you were just saying your son was in
my Brown. My oldest went to Villanova.
Okay.
And she's married now with a baby. I have a grandson. And my son went to Brown. Played baseball at Brown, and then my youngest at Penn. And then my son finished baseball, went back to Columbia to get his MBA.
Look at him.
I mean,
I'm taking no credit for this. Trust me.
Yeah, no offense.
I'm wearing the hat. That's all.
You say no offense, but you went to St. John's.
I went to St. John's. I barely got out of St. John's.
St. John's got to worry about the high school that you went to. I went to Lafayette High School.
Where Colfax and Wilpon went to.
You know, it was on the mind that guy. There was that left arm of yours, Johnny. You know, I'm glad that you took the time to stop in, and we do appreciate having it. Can't wait to have this fun hour with you talking some sports. I wanted to say the genesis of this conversation, though. We were at the, I think it was the Ranger game first. It was the St. John's game that first night that BT hooked us up with court seats. And I see Johnny across the floor. You're always there at the Garden, whatever. They show you on the big screen. And then we kind of ran into each other on the subway a little bit, but I didn't see, you said you saw me.
I wasn't sure if it was you. You know, like when you're on a subway and you see someone and you say, I don't know, could that be Sal or not? And I was like 10 feet from him. But I was like kind of embarrassed. Like, hey, Sal, what's going on? If it wasn't Sal, then I feel like an idiot, you know? So,
might get stabbed if it's not.
Yeah, that too. That way I can self-defense myself. You know? But when I get off the train at Chambers and he got off the train, and I was like, wait a minute, why is Sal, doesn't he live in Long Island or something? Why is he down here? Then when I get off the train, I text you. And you said, yeah, I just got off the train. I said, so did I. So that's how we got
there. That started. And then the next night at the Ranger game, I happened to go to the Ranger game. And I see you there sitting in front of Harvey and Seal and all that stuff. And then, and this is what I really wanted to get into. And then that led to, it was right around the Hall of Fame time. So like the next day, because you were fresh in my mind, I started thinking about, I was doing the show at Beningo, I think, that Saturday Mason. I'm like, and I told you, BT, about this, like, God, I think John Franco could be a Hall of Famer. And I'm thinking I'm doing like a nice service here for my friend Johnny Franco. So I'm like, you know what? He should be a Hall of Famer. And I text him the clip of me doing it. He's like, you think? So your thoughts on where you're at as far as the Hall of Fame goes. We made this case for you. You know, and even BT the next day was like, I don't know. Because the initial thought, maybe not. But then you do the numbers and you go over who's in. And we're both like, there's a good argument. You should be a Hall of Famer.
You know, my dad always said I was the invisible man. So I could put up the same numbers as the Lee Smiths and all that stuff. And they would get all the notoriety. And I was, because I wasn't a hard thrower, right? So that's what everybody loves, the power pitchers. That's, a, you know, nothing. Billy Wagner was great. He deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. But he was a power pitcher. He strikeout. Everybody loved that. I did it with more finesse. You know, when I first came up, I was 93, 94 miles an hour. And as I got older, I learned how to pitch a little bit better. My super changeup. And that's how I learned how to pitch. But everybody falls in love with the power pitchers. And that's one of the reasons why I think I kind of get overlooked sometimes.
I think one of the other reasons, because they're right. My first instinct was terrific player, couple of all-stars, short of the Hall of Fame when we had the discussion on the air. And I didn't realize, was it three All-Stars with the Reds or two? It was at least two.
Three with the Reds, and one with the Mets.
Okay, so one thing that I think, and I didn't know that it was quite three. We were younger. I mean, obviously, we knew you were there. We knew you were one of us from here, but we knew you went to St. John's. I didn't know you made three All-Star teams with Cincinnati, and I think it hurt you. Like, if you would have been with the Mets for the first 10, 11 years, and you made, say, five All-Star teams, three early with the Mets instead of the Reds, I feel like you had a fragmented career that some people forgot about the early days in Cincinnati.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had some good years in Cincinnati. You know, Pete Rose was my manager, so that was interesting, too. But I get overlooked quite a bit. You know, sometimes I look at the list and guys who are in the Hall of Fame, and my numbers are, if not better, almost the same, equal to them. A lot of those guys pitched before this, the analytics. I mean, when I was eligible for the Hall of Fame, there was no analytics and sabermetrics and stuff like that. So then there was only, I think, three or four guys in the Hall of Fame relievers at the time when I was eligible. And unfortunately, I only got 4.6%. And I remember I got a phone call from a writer. I won't mention his name, but I'll tell you guys off the air.
Okay.
And he called me and told me he didn't vote for me because he didn't believe in the save statistic.
Really?
Oh, and he was one of our local guys.
Really? So, was it Lupica?
No.
I was played against him.
That's even more of an insult.
So I just said, why the F are you calling me? And I hung up on him.
Good for you.
Was it the last time you spoke to him?
I won't speak to him no more.
Wow.
Good for you, Johnny. Yeah. I love that. Just to give you the numbers, 2.89 career ERA. By the way, you screwed that up. 43, 44 years of age, hanging on with the Mets in 04 and then the Astros in 05.
Right.
And your ERA jumped 5.28 and then 7.20. So could have had an even better ERA, but still 2.89.
Yeah, it's my last year with the Astros, I started off really good. And, you know, when your mind says, yeah. But then around June, the month of June and then July, really, my ball wasn't breaking, my fastball wasn't moving, and I got hit around pretty good. And I kind of knew the end was near because we had a doubleheader in Cincinnati. Ironically, that's where I started my career, and that's where I ended my career in Cincinnati. I got released in Cincinnati.
I didn't know that. I don't remember that.
427 career saves as well, BT. So as we mentioned before, I think you had, we were doing a better ERA than Lee Smith and more saves than Billy Wagner, and both those guys are in. So,
well, yeah. I mean, more saves than the other guys that are in the two, the Gosses and the Suters.
So. See, here's my problem with guys who get in eventually, and you might down the road.
Yeah.
You don't get to celebrate it, enjoy it the way you do, because invariably over 10, 15, 20, 30 years, people pass away.
Right.
People that saw your journey,
right,
that you would love to be there with you. Yeah, you get in maybe,
right,
but the celebrations, it's a little bit empty because people that were there your whole life are no longer with us, unfortunately.
Absolutely. You know, my brother passed away 2 years ago. My parents passed away years ago. So, I mean, now I have my wife, my kids, my grandson, so my close friends. So, you know, God willing, we'll see what happens with the Veterans Committee. And that's the other thing. You have to get onto that. You have to be selected to get on that. So a few years ago, there was the Veterans Committee, and then all of a sudden, they changed it to the modern day contemporary era.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on that 16 list, and then they cut it to 8. And I was one of the guys, myself, Lou Whitaker, Keith Hernandez, we got cut from that list.
Think about the names. Whitaker, the Tigers in 84, they start 35-5, Trammell, Keith was Keith. I mean,
so I got cut from that
list. Generation.
The thing that hurts me still, I think, is the steroid guys are still being put on this list that are, you know,
so taking up spots.
They're taking up spots. So
did you know guys were cheating when you were playing? And you just
didn't know, but you could tell. I mean, I was, you know, a guy left 185 and came back 220. You know, something's like, wait a minute, his neck, and he looked like a, you know, he left as a goat and came back as a bull. So, yeah.
Did you ever think about taking it?
No.
Why not? I mean, if I'm you, and I respect, I believe you.
Yeah.
But if I'm you, if I could get 2-3 miles an hour on the radar gun with that changeup, how were you not tempted? Everybody was doing it.
Listen, I played during the steroid era, the live ball era.
Yeah. The cocaine era, the back end of the cocaine era.
Exactly. So I didn't need none of that. I played with my heart, and that's all. That was big enough to get me to where I had to get to.
BT and Sal on the Fan. We're in studio with John Franco right now. You mentioned Pete Rose before. Did you ever sense there were any, you know?
It's funny. Everybody always had asked me that, and from what they say, Pete always bet to win, the Reds to win. And I was closing at the time. So if we were winning the game and I wasn't in the game, I knew something would be up. But you know, during football season, here's a perfect example. During football season, our games in Cincinnati started at 1:15. A bunch of guys would stay in the locker room until about 2 to watch, you know, the football, right? You know what I'm saying? And you'd come up and Pete would be on the top step. And he'd say, hey, did you get a Bengals score? And yeah, the Bengals were up 6-3. What about the Jets? You know, I'm a Jet fan, right?
Probably losing like always.
You know, the Jets, whatever. So you didn't think nothing of it. You know, just like all the other players, we were just thinking that, you know, we're football fans and we'd like to, during football season. I never thought that he was betting on baseball until everything came out.
Did you like playing for him? Was he a good guy?
I loved playing for him. He was great. He deserved to be in the Hall of Fame just because of what he did as a player. I loved playing for him. He had two rules: play hard and be on time. And if you didn't play hard, he let you know.
Mm-hmm.
He let you know for sure.
You played with some good guys. Unfortunately, with the Reds, you left there just as they were going to the World Series with Pinella. What year were you there with Pinella as well?
No. So that winter, I got traded. But prior to that, there was some talks about me going to the Yankees. And all in the papers. So then our general manager at the time, I think it was Murray Cook at the time, had called me and said, Lou Piniella's a manager. He wants to have lunch with you in the Short Hills Mall.
Oh, wow.
Because Lou was out there.
Yeah.
And he had asked me, gentlemen, you know, we want to probably give you a 3-year deal. What are you looking for? I said, I don't know. You know, I haven't talked to my agent. So that was like at the end of November. Then they had the winter meetings. And then the next day I know it was, I got a phone call from Murray Cook saying, you've been traded to New York. So I thought it was the Yankees. So I said, okay, whatever. And then hung up the phone, and then Marge Schott called.
Oh.
And she didn't know nobody's name. She was just saying, hi, honey, sorry that you know. And I just gave the phone to my wife, and my wife was talking to her for about 20 minutes because she didn't know what, not my wife, but Marge didn't know what the hell she was talking about.
Wow.
And then 15 minutes later, Joe McElvain called me from the Mets. So I was like, oh, man, I grew up a Mets fan.
Yeah.
My brother was a Mets fan. So it was this great coming back home and that was a long night for me. We partied pretty good that night.
I love it. Who was your favorite Met growing up?
Tug McGraw,
yep.
Tom Seaver. And I was very fortunate enough to meet both of them. Tom Seaver was a guest instructor down in spring training when I was there. He was great. Some of the young guys like Pulsifer and Isringhausen, and those guys didn't know much about Tom Seaver.
Uh-huh.
And I used to tell them, come inside and listen to this guy. And they said, I said, sit your butt down and just listen to him talk. And he was amazing. He was nice enough to, when I went out, my wife surprised me with a trip to Napa Valley. And I went out to see Tom because he had his vineyard out there.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
got great wine, Cabernet GTS.
I think Boomer made it out there too a couple years ago.
I need to get a bottle of that.
It was awesome. So
wow.
I pull up to his gate and he's got this big gate, number 41 on the gate. And I ring the bell and the gate opens and I come down. I was with my wife and a friend of mine and his wife. And we come down and he has these big, big Labradors, about 90 pounds. And they're running towards the car. And I don't know if they were attack dogs or whatever. And he's laughing, laughing, laughing. So he says one word and the dogs just go. And he said, welcome to Casa Seaver, you know. And I got out of the car, and it was great. And I said, what about these dogs? Oh, they scare away the mountain lions.
Oh, yeah, so a lot like, up there, yeah.
Yeah, so he gave us a tour of his vineyard. He had, I think it was 80 acres, but only 40 was for the
grapes. For the vineyards?
Yeah. And he would show us around. We were going up and down, and he had everything. He did his own pruning himself.
He did?
And he gave me a grape and taste this. He said, taste this grape. And I said, oh, man, this tastes terrible. And he said, what are you eating it for? It's all rotten. I said, well, you gave it to me. You know, Tom Seaver tells you to eat something, you're going to eat it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I did that. I ate it. But it was funny because then he had this big oak tree and two chairs and a little table there. And every day when he was finished pruning, he would sit there, and his wife Nancy would bring out a tray with lunch, and they have some wine. He'd do his crossword puzzle underneath the tree, and he had a baseball on top of a pole. And I said, "What's the baseball doing there?" So that's where I know I have to start tomorrow to start pruning. I always put a baseball where
that's
I have to start.
That's tremendous.
So it was pretty awesome.
How did you find out he was traded? How old were you? That must have destroyed you.
When Seaver?
Yeah.
Well, I was what. When did he get traded? In 84?
No, 77.
77? Well, I was 17 at the time.
I mean, that must have crushed you.
Yeah, I mean, it's Seaver.
Oh, my God.
Tug McGraw. That 69 Met team was my team. You know, I got to meet Tommy Agee. I mean, even Cleon Jones now when I see him. And Buddy Harrelson was our coach for the Mets when I was there for a little bit. Just to see those 69 guys and the way you grew up rooting for those guys. And now I've shared a locker room with them or talking to them. It was great. And Seaver tinkered with my slider. He showed me, you know, I wasn't happy with my slider, so I had he showed me his slider grip, and I used that a couple of times with his grip. So it was just to pick up one or two things, and I was very fortunate to have him at camp. And then on the flip side of it, Fred Wilpon was great friends with Sandy Koufax.
Yeah.
And Koufax would come in, and there was this, wow, I was great. My father was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. And I'll tell you a quick story with Sandy. So Sandy came to camp. And we all went out to dinner, all the lefties, Al Leiter, I think Glavin, myself, I forgot the other lefty. And we had a couple bottles of wine, and Sandy's talking about pitching, how as a left-handed pitcher, you should be on the first base side of the rubber and should be able to hit the outside corner 8 out of 10 times, 9 out of 10 times. And now Leiter, my buddy, is total opposite.
Yeah.
Could throw a strike if you
had. No, but he slider in, cutter in, you know, this and that, right? So fast forward, we're playing a game in Atlanta, and I come in relief for Armando Benitez. He's load the bases up. And I get the first guy out. This pitch haunts me from the day out until the day I die. So I had an 0-2 pitch on Brian Jordan. He missed the changeups by that much. So I figured, let me sneak a fastball off the plate inside. It came leaking back out. It's a grand slam, game loser, on my birthday. About 20 minutes later, my phone rings. Sandy, and he said, hey, dumbass, didn't I tell you to keep the ball away? And he hung up.
Wow. Happy birthday, Johnny.
Happy birthday.
Now, wait a second. This was 2001?
I think it was 99.
Before that.
99.
This was against the Braves late in
before
the season.
Before the playoffs, late in the season.
Right, but I don't know why I'm thinking 01 where you guys missed the playoffs. What did you miss the playoffs that
in 99,
year?
We were in the playoffs.
No, that I remember. That's why I'm saying I think this home run that you gave up to Gil.
I think it was
Brian
99
Jordan.
Or 98.
Jordan,
one of those years. I know it was late.
Maybe it was 98 that you missed it. I feel like I was at Home Depot at the time, and I was angry with you.
You and Joe Beningo.
I'm sure we weren't alone. BT and Sal on the fan with John Franco in studio. You mentioned before something that, like, when you were a leader of this team, talking about Izzy and Pulse, Generation K, back in the mid-90s, when did you become captain for the Mets?
In 2001, I believe.
Wow, so that, okay, 2001 with the Mets. So after that, but you were already acting like a captain in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I had the respect of my teammates. I always made sure that everybody, you know, my job as a relief pitcher, the thing that hurt me the most and bothered me the most was not if I blew a save. And I blew a save for Sal or Brendan because you guys pitched seven innings and broke your back and you had nothing to show for it. That bothered me more than blowing a save and getting a loss because you guys get paid on wins and losses. Mm-hmm. And that would bother me so much that it did really ate at me. And there was a lot of sleepless nights because I blew it for my teammates. But I always got along with my teammates. Always made sure that if a guy was down and out or struggling, go up to talk to him. You put your arm around him or talk to him and point to the sun and say, hey, dude, that sun came up today. And Jim Cott did that to me as a pitching coach in Cincinnati. He came up, put his arm around you after you had a tough outing and said, the sun come out and just turned the page. So you have to have a short-term memory.
Yeah.
So it's and that's what I did. I would go and talk to the guys, and I would just tell the guys, listen, take it for it. You want to tell me to shut up? Tell me to get the hell away from you. But I'm just going to give you a little advice, give you a little, you know, a little something to make you feel better or not feel better. But, dude, it's a long season. Forget about what happened today or yesterday. Today's a new day. And just let's move on. And I always made sure that when we went into a visit in town, always had six, seven guys to go out for a steak dinner. And just the camaraderie of the guys. You know, if we had an off day somewhere, we'd go golfing or go to a movie, go to Alcatraz. You know, just a group of guys. And that's always was that type of guy to make sure that everybody stuck together. We were all on the same page and make sure that nobody pointed their fingers at each other because that's how things get disruptive in the locker room.
How'd you find out that you were the captain? How did they name it?
I think Turk Wendell started it, and he went into Bobby V, and then the general manager at the time, I think it was Steve Phillips still, or what, I think. And
I think Steve was still there at that point.
And they came up to me, and they said, hey, we want to make you captain of this team. And I said, well, it's a great honor. It's very rare that a relief pitcher is a captain.
Is that the first one in the history of baseball? Honestly.
It could be, maybe. I don't know. So it's very rare that a relief pitcher is usually an everyday player.
Yeah.
So I said, I'd be happy. You know, but that's a captain. What do you do? What do you do? You know,
you put the C on the chest.
You put the C on the chest like a hockey player. You
do the same thing, though, you would be anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And you know, you go, and if the guy had a family issue or something was going on, and I'd talk to him, or I'd go to the coach, Bobby, and talk to Bobby, or I'd go to a general manager. And I always try to help the player out or another player. If there's something going on in the locker room where somebody said something about somebody, I always call a team meeting and make sure to clear the air that, hey, you know, you're just the same. We're all on the same page. Let's not point fingers at each other. It's a long season. You know, if I blow a save, I'm not pointing a save. You know, somebody made an error behind me. We're all on the same season. And then I had some muscle behind me, too, in case they didn't like it. You know, I'm a little guy, but I'll fight you until I can't fight you. Uh-huh. But that's what it is, you know, that's what a captain is. And it's a leader, a guy who gets along with everybody, a guy who I think has the respect of everybody, respect of the whole organization. And that's what I had. I felt good about that, too.
You think the Mets have that with Francisco Lindor?
Oh, absolutely. I said it the other day. I think he'd be a right choice. No disrespect to Pete or Brandon Nimmo, the guys who have been there a long time. I just think he has this certain R about him, you know, that certain everyday guy. He's always smiling, whether he's 0-4 or 4-4. He's always talking to the young players. I mean, I saw a clip in spring training just a couple of days ago where he was talking to somebody about, I guess they were going back on pop-ups or something, talking about that. I think he'd be great. I think he's an unofficial team captain right now without the C on him.
Kind of like you were, right?
Yeah. So I guess eventually they'll put the C on him, I think. I think he'd be a great captain. I think Pete would be a nice captain. I think Brendan would be a nice captain. But I think he has a little bit more edge on him.
What he does really well, and I didn't really know this about him because first bunch of years were at the Guardians. Anybody could be a leader when you're doing well. Hey, you're hitting .330 for the month of June. Hey, I'm in a good mood. I got three knocks tonight and we're winning. Everything's good. Yeah. You know, when you're hitting .160 to start a season, or, you know, you boot a ball that's short, and I remember it was a Pittsburgh game 2 years ago. We stood at the front of his locker, very accountable. And the thing that I didn't, not that I didn't think he was willing to do it, I just, I didn't really ever see him do it like this. he was the leader when he was playing poorly. Yeah. And it takes a special person to do that, because when you're not playing well, people generally don't follow you.
Absolutely. And you're right. You know, he had a couple of, the first couple of months, he struggled. You know, just like when Piazza got here, Piazza struggled for the first couple of weeks and people were booing him. And I was like, what are they booing him for? Come on now, give the guy a shot. But no, he's held himself accountable. He, like you said, 0-for-4. But he don't get no hits, but he can make four great plays in the field and save the game that way. You know, there was that talk last year of Ohtani and Lindor.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Ohtani's a DH. He goes 0-for-4 and a team loses. If Lindor goes 0-for-4, but he makes four great plays to save a game and wins a game for the team. So that's the difference between the DH and him playing.
So you think that Lindor should have won
it? I think he should have got real close. Should have been real close. Ohtani's a different animal himself. He's a phenomenal player, but I think, from everyday playing shortstop every day, not taking a day off. The guy got hit in the face with a fastball last year or two years ago,
yeah,
and stood in the game. Didn't want to come out of the game.
Even when he was, I think this was 2 years ago against the Dodgers, he got his finger slammed in a hotel door. He played like the next night.
Exactly. So, you know, he has my respect.
Yeah.
If I was a teammate of his, I would surely love to have him as captain, not only for the regular players, but for the young Latin players on the team, too. I think the guys look up to him also.
We'll take a quick break, come back with more. Johnny Franco, before we do, what'd you ever get for that Piazza, giving him a 31?
I had, Mike had the famous artist. Leroy Neiman painted a portrait of me.
Really? That's what he gave him?
Yeah,
all right, not bad.
Cool.
You still have it, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
And then you had to wear the 45 with the C on it, but...
Yeah,
all right.
That's
Mike,
all right.
You had to make Mike pay up a little bit.
Yeah, Mike. When Mike first got traded, I had him stay at my house when I lived in Staten Island for a couple of days, and we had the same agent, so it was pretty cool.
Okay, all right. BT and Sal on the Fan In Studio with John Franco. BT and Sal back on the Fan In Studio with John Franco, Mets legend, also St. John's alum. We're getting some good stories during the break about that. I see you at the Garden all the time. You fired up about the Johnny's hoops?
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait. Sundays are going to be a great game, too. You know, 12 o'clock start.
Tell him, Johnny. Husky's going down, buddy. Let him know.
Just enough time to get home to have the pasta, and, you know, after the Johnny's win, it was nice.
You cooking the pasta or what?
Since I retired, I do all the cooking.
Look at this. I think Mazzilli was the same thing. Remember he was telling us when we had
him
at
that
golf outing?
He likes to cook, too.
I like to cook.
All of a sudden, you guys cooking.
So do I. Men cook. You just don't cook.
No, no, no. I didn't say it's not a men or women thing. I'm just saying it.
You don't cook.
I don't cook. My wife doesn't cook either.
When I played, my wife made sure there was food on the table right before I left every game. So she cooked for 20-something years when I played.
Do you have a certain pregame meal that you would always...
My pregame meal was spaghetti with garlic and oil.
Oh, okay.
That was my...
And then afterward, you go ham? What would you get? What were you eating after the game? After a nice win?
Like after a Mets win? Yeah. Depending on what they had. After the locker room, you know, we had Italian food, Chinese food, Mexican food. Every night was different.
Seven beers.
Yeah.
Well, that's when you could drink beers. Before, you know, if back in the day, you know, the game would end at 10:30. You wouldn't get home till 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. But you sit around and talk about the game.
Yeah.
That's now, you know, obviously you can't drink and drive, but back
for
then.
For sure.
You know.
It was more, right, it was more open.
Even the,
more
plane, even the flights back, there was a... We had a flight back one time, and a couple of teammates, I won't mention their names.
What year?
Frank Howard was our manager, our coach, so I can't remember the year exactly. And we got off he was going home, and three of our players got into a little accident, and Hondo pulled up the side of him, and he says, "You guys all right?" And they said, "Yeah, Hondo, we're fine." He says, "I'll see you tomorrow."
I mean, we shouldn't even laugh, but that's how it was
back then. Yeah, but now, it was great. It was good.
You're going down to Port St. Lucie soon to be instructor
with the
Mets?
Yeah, I got a phone call from Carlos Mendoza a couple weeks ago, invited me down to be a special instructor. So I'm leaving. I'll be down Monday to Friday.
And what do you do when you're down there? You help these younger guys? You let them know?
You know, whatever they want me to do. You know, I'll just stay out of the way unless they ask an opinion or something like that. I'll help out. It's good to go down there. And I know, I think Santana's down there now. Or he's going to be
Johan,
there.
Okay.
Yeah, and myself, Edgar Alfonso, I think David might be down there, and Straw.
Oh, nice. There you go. Yeah. And listen, you have to do what Seaver did for you with the slider. Right, you got to teach him a little, you know, like tweak the change up grip.
Yeah,
that's kind of what you're going down there for, right?
Yeah, you go down and just try to stay out of the way because there's a certain protocol that they have to follow, and you know,
like the pitching coaches have their own. You can't.
You know, you just don't want to step on anybody's toes, and you don't want, you know, it's like I don't want to tell you to do something without telling them. If I see something, I would tell the pitching coach. Hey,
gotcha. You run it by them.
Yeah, Sal is. You know,
right,
crazy
leaking out. Sal is, you know, he's
but you're John Franco, Mets Hall of Famer.
That you know, that's...
You know what I'm saying?
The game, game has changed so much, not just in our organization, but the whole thing about that. So,
well, how surprised or how concerned were you at some points fairly recently that Pete wasn't coming back?
It's very concerning. I mean, I'm glad he is back. You know, he's that lineup gets stretched out a little longer. We needed some protection for behind Soto. I don't know what the lineup's going to be, but whatever the lineup is, you know, it's hard to find a guy who's going to put up 30 home runs and 80 plus RBIs a year, no matter, you know, what his average is. He's hit 30 bombs a year. So,
40, usually
yeah,
it's 40.
Yeah. So I'm glad he's back. Yeah. He, you know, it's funny, when he got, I think he got drafted, I forgot what year he got drafted. I was the player who called him.
Is that true?
I represented the Mets, and with the first pick of the 1990, the New York Mets select first baseman Pete Alonso from Florida.
Yeah, wow,
so
that's
when
cool.
I see Pete, I said, I want some agent there.
Well, now he's got a little more for you. 30 million this year.
He got a lot more for me. Have
you ever seen? Yeah, no. I hate to even bring this up, but I don't want to get more into this. But obviously, you were part of the Mets team that went to the World Series and lost to the Yankees.
Yeah.
How about the magnitude of Soto leaving the Yankees to sign with the Mets?
Wow, that's pretty big. I mean, I know if the Mr. Steinbrenner was allowed, I don't think that would have happened. But, you know, hats off to our owner, Steve Cohn, because, you know, he knew this is the player he wanted and he was going to spend whatever. I think it's a little shot for the Yankees because, you know, he was a big part of their lineup. So it's going to hurt them a little bit, but the Yankees brought in some pretty good players, you know.
I like what the Yankees
Goldschmidt
did, but his point, I get what his point is, like,
yeah,
that never happened.
No,
never.
George is turning over in his grave right now. That would never happen.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you were at peak Mets, really the beginning, because you were there for the first Subway Series ever in 97. Lived through all that with the Yankee dynasty as a player for the Mets, lost to them head-to-head in the World Series. Since then, I mean, we go back to the 80s, sure, the Mets ran the town for a little while, but since then it has been dominant one way
absolutely.
For 30 years. Yeah. And to have this happen, to steal their guy?
Yeah, to steal their guy. And listen, as a player, you have the right to become a free agent and pick and choose wherever you want to go. And that's what Juan did. He picked and chose, and he picked the Mets. We're glad he picked the Mets. I'm glad he picked the Mets.
They're going to hit him second or third. You know, like Davey's not hitting him second. You know, Bobby V's probably not hitting him second. I know the game's changed a little bit.
Where do you think
he hits?
I don't know where he hits. I mean, Lindor's got to lead off, that's for sure.
Yep.
I would hit him third. I mean,
I would hit Vientos second, John. I would go Lindor, Vientos, and then Soto.
See, that's another thing. You know, you got the Vientos hit 20-something home runs. Hopefully he can repeat that, you know? The catcher? Francisco
Alvarez,
he's got a hit too, you know. So there's a lot of pressure on him too.
If you were facing him to close out a game, Johnny Franco comes on, music
facing
is playing.
Who?
Well, what do you think would be more challenging, Lindor, Soto, Vientos, or Alonso? Like, if you,
it don't matter who I face.
Yeah, Barry Bonds.
It don't matter.
Bonds, you got him, Johnny.
Barry to this day still says it was a ball. I said, "What the umpire calls? Strikes or suck on it."
Go take some more pills, there, Barry. While you're at
it, suck on it, man.
You have one that sticks with you. By the way, the Brian Jordan one, I'm pretty sure I have this on replay here. It was 2001. I remember that.
Oh, thanks, Sal.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, thank you.
Let me see this meatball. Flip this around.
No.
You didn't hit the outside corner?
I'll restart right here. I'm pretty sure.
Hang on. All right, so he's trying to. I got it. Hang on.
Oh, no. It was a pitch right down the plate.
Oh, you can't miss it like that, John.
Tell me about it. I have nightmares about that.
Oh, up and away. He crushed it.
Colfax told you.
Is there one that sticks with you? The World Series, I remember game one. Did both you and Benitez cough up leads in that game?
No, not me.
Maybe it was game. Maybe I'm thinking of game six in Atlanta in 99. Yeah. You guys had a lead, you blew it, then Benitez blew it, and then obviously Kenny Rogers. Is there one that sticks with you? More so a blown save in a big spot? That one right here,
That one bothered me the most. I mean, you know, usually the playoffs, I did pretty well in the playoffs. My numbers in the playoffs were pretty damn
good. Bonds one was incredible.
Yeah. You know, the story about what Bonds was, prior to that, John Olerud was our first baseman for the Mets, and John Olerud was a tremendous hitter, left-handed. And I went up to John Olerud, I sit on the bench, and I said, "What's the toughest pitch for you to hit against a lefty?" And he said, "A changeup." And I said, "Why?" Because they never throw it. So I just put that in the back of my head. So all the years I faced Barry and I, we had the same agent, and I used to mess around with him so bad. I said, "Man, I don't know how I get you out. You're the greatest player ever, blah, 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 la, la, la." And Barry says, "When I hit a home run off you, I'm going to run around the bases backwards." And I said, "Man, I don't know, man. You're so great. I don't know how I get you out." And he almost got me one time, hit one off the wall at Shea Stadium. And it just so happens that that day, that game. So I came in the game for Benitez, and first guy was a man on first. They bunt him over to second. Next guy hits a rocket, one hop at a shortstop. The guy on second tries to go to third. We throw him out at third. So now I got two outs, man on first, and I'm facing Bonds. First pitch ball, second pitch ball, next pitch a strike, 2-1. I throw 3-1. Then he hits a 3-1 fastball. If he would have hit it, it would have landed in Oakland.
Oh, man.
So now I'm saying, man, Piazza's putting fastball. I'm saying, no. And I said, let me throw a changeup. What the hell? If I walk him, I walk him. And I threw a changeup, and it just happens it was a strike. And he looked at it. I don't think he was expecting it.
I'm watching it now, BT. We got it up in
here. It's a good one. I got to see it after. Is it Johnny?
Yeah. Punch him out, baby. Sit that ball. That was great, but, Johnny.
Know, in the two games after that, I faced him again. I got him out with a high fastball.
Because now you got him thinking. Yeah. You got him getting because now he saw another pitch.
Exactly.
I think I know the answer, but I obviously want to hear from you. So even though he got Bonds out and had good success against him, somebody like Bonds or even Judge, Soto, you know, is it easier in quotes, to face a guy like that in a high leverage spot or a high contact hitter like a Gwynn or a Boggs or a Brett? What's the tougher battle?
It's funny you say that. So I'd rather face a home run hitter like Bonds and, you know, Judge, Soto, than a Gwynn. Gwynn's numbers are probably off the chart against me because I was in the Western Division when Cincinnati was in the West. So I faced them, and I used to try to get him out, a fastball in, base hit to fastball away, base hit. Fastball, basically.
Wore you out.
Yeah. So I said, the hell with it. I'm going to throw one right down the middle. I hope he hits a line drive at somebody. You can't get him out. I mean,
he was that good. Yeah.
But a guy like Gwynn, a guy who owned me was Mariano Duncan.
I remember him. I don't remember him owning you.
When we played today. We went to today. That's it.
When you were Cincinnati?
Okay. He was with the Dodgers
for a little bit. Oh, yeah.
I think he's obviously with the Yankees.
The Yankees, of course, yeah. He was on the 96 team.
He just had to put his bat in there. There was just certain guys you couldn't get out.
Really?
There was something. And Glenn Allen Hill.
He was a home run hitter.
Yeah, he was a steroid guy.
Yeah, he was.
So I gave up 3 home runs to him as pinch hitter.
What about somebody like Mike Schmidt?
No problem.
Schmidt.
Andre Dawson.
Really? Why? Do they have longer swings?
No, it's just, I don't know. It's just, you know, I guess you bear down a little bit more. So, yeah, but Glenn Allen hit it a home run in Wrigley Field against a 3-0 pitch, that son of a gun.
Oh,
he was taking it. He hit it halfway up the ivy in center field. That was a bomb. One of the longest home runs I've given up to this day was Tim Wallach.
Oh, yeah, I remember
Expos,
him.
Expos, baseman.
He hit one halfway.
He was good.
In a mezzanine, almost halfway up in a mezzanine at Citi Field.
At Shea Stadium.
It would have landed in LaGuardia if the field was there.
Did you ever face Mattingly? I don't think you did. Did you?
I faced him spring training. I faced Donnie, Bernie, and I forgot who the third guy
was. Paul O'Neill?
No.
Tino? One of those? Oh, no, Tino was gone.
Those guys you faced for real.
There was another. Winfield. Winfield, Donnie, and
Ricky. Ricky was with Winfield.
What?
And Winfield was with, I'm sorry, Mattingly was with Winfield and Ricky.
Right.
But not, well, yeah, Bernie, young Bernie,
Bernie
was coming up. That's true.
So I believe I faced it was Bernie, but I know it was Winfield, Donnie.
And?
KKK.
Oh, look at Johnny.
You struck out my boy?
I love it. Yeah. Now, unfortunately, the 2000 World Series, Johnny. And we'll get to that. We're going to take a quick break. Hey, would you be cool, you know, we do this segment where we open pack of cards.
Yeah, yeah. Give me
a year that you think you'd be okay with. We have, I think, 84. It's not a year. 84 through, like, 91. What do you think you'd be best at?
I don't know. You guys pick it
out. Okay, all right.
I thought right in the middle. We'll go 86, 87, okay, whatever. See what you got.
We'll pick one out when we come back. BT and Sal in studio with John Franco.
That's going to be awesome.
Even though I dislike the Knicks, I do enjoy Knick Fan TV after every win and loss, so it's always good to see you. What are you giving me?
I came bearing gifts, man. That was also another reason why I was late. If you may, I'll just pass it over to Mr. Ross.
He's passing something over to me.
I got some for Loogie, because I know Loogie likes to rock the beanies, man.
Oh, he's got a Knicks Fan TV shirt.
This is for Loogie, man.
That's very nice.
For the stretch run. And for you, Mr. Roberts.
See, the problem is I like Knicks Fan TV, but I'm not a Knicks fan. So if I put
Loogie
this on, am I selling out my team?
No, you're a season ticket holder. Yeah. What do you wear when you go to these games?
Nothing. I just wear a regular shirt.
You're one of those people I have an issue with. I have an issue with those type of people. Show up to the games, they're just in like regular, you know.
The button downs.
The button down, a little sweater.
It's still Mets colors.
I'm going to go to my next Knicks game is Knicks Warriors. I want to see Steph a little bit.
There you go.
And Draymond, your buddy.
Yeah.
I'm going to wear this to the Knicks game. But it doesn't make me a Knicks fan, correct?
No, it makes you a fan of Knicks Fan TV.
That's right.
All right, I appreciate that.
Dribble.
I got you next time. I didn't know you were going to be here. I got you next time.
CP, do not worry about me.
Well, I
shirt looks horrible. I never wear it anyway.
That's a very nice gesture. Thank you for the shirt.
Oh, and Tommy, look, okay. I want to sell out Tommy.
Yeah. Lugie's right got on. It on, man.
Bro, I saw Chuck D wearing it at the Knick game the other night. I was
absolutely.
Like, I almost texted CP. I was like, my man, that's cool. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. That is very cool. I did see that as well.
Yes.
Very cool. Well, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
All of
thank you very much for this. It's very nice.
Yeah.
Should I put it on now?
It's just now getting so awkward.
That would be fantastic, man. You know?
He's going to take his shirt off now?
He also didn't unplug his headphones first.
He did not unplug the headphones.
So now that's going to be a problem.
There we go.
There you go.
That looks good, man. Nice screen print. Vibrant orange.
That's color. You know what I like about the shirt and the way that fits?
What's
oftentimes, that? Evan's shirts can be hit or miss based on his male breasts. And there's no male breastage in that shirt
true.
At all.
You're
good
right.
fabric, CP. Good fabric.
It is dad bod friendly, man.
Not 40. And it feels, and it is met color, so it does make me feel better.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, my man.
Yeah, sure.
I appreciate it.
All of
them. All right, let's get to this basketball team that you root for.
Yes.
Is Mitchell Robinson ever going to come back?
Well, you know, his team, they do a great job with the propaganda. You know, they send me. He was down at Vanderbilt during the All-Star break getting some work in. He looks slim and trim. I'm hearing that it could be around March, you know, that he could be coming back, and they're going to need him. It has been a little bit concerning, though, I will tell you.
Yeah, because the other concern I have is even if he does come back in mid-March, is he going to stay out on the floor? Because that's the biggest issue with him. Like, okay, he can come out and certainly add something to this team that they desperately need, but, like, can he play? Is he going to continue through April and May if the run continues?
I that's what you hope, right? Because at the end of the day, they're not looking for him to start. They're not looking for him to start and log major minutes like the rest of these guys are doing. But Mitchell Robinson, you're looking for him to fill that role right now. That's kind of filled by Ariel Hukporti. A couple minutes with Karl Anthony Towns.
That's James Dolan's favorite player, Ariel Hukporti.
Yeah, he gave him the stamp of approval. But you want to see that Twin Tower lineup with Karl Anthony Towns, because with Towns at the five right now, they are not a championship contender. They're just not.
And they will only, after Mitchell comes back, play the Sixers once, and Embiid probably won't play, so no sharpshooters.
That's right. Yeah, but you see, that's basketball karma. Yeah. You see what's happening with Joel Embiid.
Oh, yeah.
That was a dirty play.
He re-injured
the guy.
I agree.
It was a dirty play.
Well, he's a dirty player.
That's correct.
Like, when I saw it happen.
Guys, he beat Bell's palsy. No, just calm down. Give him a little credit.
Joel Embiid has always been a dirty player.
Yeah.
It's been going on for a long time. So what he did against Mitchell Robinson was typical.
Yeah.
Now, if he's healthy, you said he's not going to start. Obviously, I agree with you. How do you think Thibs deploys him when healthy?
You can go two big lineups. You can go offense, defense. There may be times where you put Karl Anthony Towns on the bench and say, hey, put Mitchell Robinson in the middle there. OG Anunoby at the four once he comes back. I think OG will be back soon right after this break. And it gives the defense a much-needed boost because now you have wing stop, which is Josh Hart, Cal Bridges, who's playing much better defense.
Yeah, he has been, absolutely.
And OG Anunoby, he's your wild card. He's your guy who's going to get super aggressive. He cheats. He goes out there. He's going to get deflections, steals, blocks. And now you have Mitchell Robinson, who's going to, one, keep opposing offenders out of the paint because that's where the Knicks have gotten into trouble, be a rim deterrent. On the offensive side, hey, if there are nights where they're off, he's one of the best offensive rebounders in the entire league when healthy. So that's what you're going to need out there to help them for this final stretch.
How do you explain, when you look at Mikal Bridges and the kind of defender he's been, OG Anunoby, the kind of defender he's been, you call him wing stop, Josh Hart too. How do you explain how bad this team has overall been defensively, especially against good teams?
They can't cover for everybody, man. And the reality is
they got two guys that can't defend.
That is it. The reality is they have two guys. You know, most teams have one guy who you're going to cover for. But with the Knicks, both Brunson and Towns are subpar defenders. Brunson's a smart defender, but he loses a lot of that with his physical limitations. Towns, same way. He can't move laterally. You put him in the drop coverage, mid-range, three-pointers, you're bombing away on him, or you're blowing right past him to the goal, and there's no backline defense that can help protect the rim. So that's the big issue with those two guys. You know, Mikal Bridges has played a lot better at the point of attack, and he's taking on Jalen Brunson's toughest assignments, the toughest guards, the point guards, the shooting guards, and so that's tough. And Tom Thibodeau said, I think, against the Hawks, you know, there's no other guy who's had to navigate as many screens as Mikal Bridges has to do on game to game, whether it's Trae Young, it's Tyrese Haliburton. So I think he's gotten a lot better there. Hart, he hasn't been that great. And that's been another issue with Josh Hart. Guys have been kind of picking him apart. I'm not sure if it's the knee injury or maybe he's pacing himself for April basketball, but he's got to get a little bit better on ball defense. But OG's the guy.
Yeah. They need him.
OG is the guy. And the tricky thing is first of all, your two best defenders who are going to help this team achieve their goals are their two injury-prone defenders.
Right. Well, that's how things can go sour real quick.
That's how it can go sour.
I mean, we saw last year with the health, and there's no way to ensure that you're going to be healthy. We could sit here all day talking about minute restrictions. That doesn't guarantee that these guys are going to be healthy when it matters the most.
No, and that's the debate that I have with the fans who turn into orthopedists and scientists and all of that. Like, you can't determine that. You had Precious Achiuwa, Deuce McBride, and Campaign all missing time in the preseason and missing regular season time with soft tissue injuries and things of that nature. It's hard to predict, but I do think with OG Anunoby, with his track record, I do think that they need to limit him a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, clearly. I mean, because I was looking at this right before his injury. He had played so much this season. He had played every game. You look at the minutes he had played. He had already played the third most minutes in his NBA career just based on the fact that he was healthy this season and he was playing big minutes. So he was already kind of exerting himself in a way that he hasn't been used to.
Yeah. They're in a tricky spot because that's a $200 million investment. And so we'll see in March 1st if they have enough money to afford a guy like a TJ Warren. If he comes up, can he get a couple minutes a night to spell these guys? Beyond this year, I think they need to hope a guy like a Pacome Dadier can emerge in his sophomore year. He's a wing, right? So to give these guys legitimate time on the bench and be confident that your bench players can deliver. So Tibbs wants to trust these guys.
Now you mentioned the buyout market.
Yeah.
They can't sign anybody who had a salary of more than, I think, $12.5 million.
Right.
They also can't sign, let's say, if my team waived Bojan Bogdanovic and he's healthy, they also couldn't sign him because you guys traded him within a year.
Yes.
So he's not an option. So you mentioned TJ Warren. Who are the other buyout options that the Knicks could possibly pluck up?
Well, you have TJ Warren. You have a guy like Chuma Okeke, who was with the G League Westchester Knicks. He signed with Philadelphia and then was just waived. So those two guys, they know the system, they know the program, those are guys who they can sign, and the reason why March 1st is a key date is because that's when the vet minimum contracts are prorated enough where they can afford these guys.
Uh-huh.
They're $533,000, I think, close to that second apron, so they have to wait until March 1st to be able to get these guys. And it's kind of tricky because, this is why I hate the CBA, because you have a team like the Boston Celtics, who are far and away above the second apron. They just go out and get Torrey Craig off of waivers when he gets cleared because they're going to pay the tax. They're going to pay that fine. But the Knicks were hard capped at that second apron and have to wait until March 1st.
Yeah, the new CBA is weird and confusing, to say the least. The bottom line is, and I've been saying this for a while with you guys, is that this is just your team.
Yeah. Like, this is it.
This is it. Now, next year, there are more avenues to improve this roster and improve the depth. Not that you're going to change the core of the team.
Yeah.
The core is the core, but right now, it's this. Can they win with this?
We'll have to see what happens when Mitch and OG come back.
What do you think, though?
I think they can get to the conference finals.
You think they can beat Boston?
I think they can get there.
If you think they can beat Boston, then they can beat Cleveland. So you think they can go to the NBA Finals?
Why not?
What you're saying.
Let's go for it.
What is your
You're not saying that with confidence, though.
Yeah, I'm always
looking into your eyes.
Last time I came here, we had the Brunson Tatum debate.
That's right.
So I stand by that.
So, okay, confidence or not.
Yeah.
If they get to that second round, they play the Boston Celtics, and the Knicks come up short, and it's another second round exit, but it's the Celtics, what is your reaction?
It's a great season.
Really?
It's a great
because
season?
It's Boston?
Because look at the team.
Yeah, but you get into the same avenue you got to last year out in the second round.
But you lost to the champs. That's not something to hang out. You lost to the champs.
No, I mean, look, the reality is the Boston Celtics are the team to beat. They just are. I mean, we could sit here and talk all day about the Thunder or the Cleveland. They got to go prove it.
Yes.
The Boston Celtics proved it last year.
Yeah.
They won an NBA championship. I don't know. The one thing I would disagree on is I don't know if I'd say it's a great season. I would say, we ran into a team that's better than us.
Exactly.
There aren't many teams left that are better than us. They happen to be one of them.
Anything is possible in the NBA playoffs.
I agree with that. Gets hurt, could change everything.
I talked about Miami's run to the finals. I talked about Indiana's improbable run to the conference finals last year. As a seventh seed, they made it. You just never know how things can play out. Teams get injured. You may have a better matchup. You may play better. Their defense may come together with OG Anunoby and Mitchell Robinson and an improved bench playing better in this second
half. I think they have a puncher's chance against Boston. What scares me is could they defend enough 4 out of 7 games against lethal shooters like that and the way they've defended the perimeter? Can they do that in 4 of 7 games? And that's where it becomes
almost tough to imagine that they can do that against Boston.
It's going to be tough. I mean, they got outscored by 80 points from three in those first two games. The opening night game against Boston and last Saturday, two Saturdays ago against Boston, when Jason Tatum, he had five Celtics in double figures. Peyton Pritchard with 22 points off the bench. He's been big for them.
Yeah, he's been great.
He's been big.
Yeah, CP, we're never going to get an honest answer out of Tommy, which is good that we have you here for that. Okay, so you call it a great season if they lose to Boston in the second round. How many years, though, of doing this with the Knicks and losing in the second round? Is there always going to be a caveat? They ran into the Celtics, they're into this, before the fan base starts to go, this isn't good enough anymore.
No, there's going to come a time when, you know, the rubber's going to meet the road and they're going to have to answer for it. And the first person to answer for it is going to be the coach.
Right.
But he's gotten us here 3 years in a row now. Four out of the last 5 years. We were in the dark ages for the last 20 years. I'm enjoying this time.
No, you should.
I'm enjoying this time. We have two all-stars. They have third seed in the East. They're going to be back in the playoffs. Most likely they'll play either the Pistons or the Pacers in the first round. They should have a favorable matchup there to get to the second round. And for these next 28 games, it is about seeing how this team improves defensively. It's all about the defense, because I know in a close game, Captain Clutch is going to deliver. He's done it 2 years in a row now, and he can do it again.
Yeah, you are in that spot where you're kind of locked in at three. Yeah, like, you're not dropping to Indiana, especially after that big win last week. You're probably not catching Boston, though it's not entirely impossible. But even if you do, you're still in that same spot where you're facing the Celtics in the second round.
Yeah.
So you kind of are in that spot where you got to go through Boston early. Would you rather face Boston early or Boston later in a conference finals?
Well, certainly later, you know, when these guys are a bit worn down.
That's my thing. They've also played a lot the last three years.
They played a lot. Yeah. So the later, the better. But we don't dodge the smoke. We're going to be ready. They're going to have to man up. But I'm going to tell you the key. Yes, it's going to be the defense. I need your guy, Mikal Bridges, to answer the call.
My guy.
We need the guy who we traded five picks for.
Yeah.
And Josh Hart keeps saying it doesn't matter until we win the championship. Well, he's the key to them winning the championship.
I agree with that.
He's the key.
Do you regret that trade?
No.
Not at all?
He hesitated, though.
No.
Hesitated because you wonder. You wonder what other star-ish player becomes available that you could have used those assets on. Especially in a world in which Luka was basically traded for the corpse of a formerly great player and one first-round pick.
Yeah.
I get why you question that.
There's only one other person who I wanted to trade for in the previous offseason, and that was your guy, Kevin Durant.
Kevin Durant.
Knicks fans thought I was crazy. I said I would pack. This was before they traded Julius for Towns.
Right.
I said I would pack Julius's bags today to bring Kevin Durant in here to help us win a championship.
The problem,
because I thought they could.
The problem with KD, and we see this now, is he's still a tremendous player. He can't stay healthy. And that's going to be the story of the rest of his NBA career, because he kind of gives me the vibe of a guy that's going to play forever.
Yes.
Like, he's going to play until the wheels come off. Like, I think he'll have a second tour of duty with my team. He may get a tour of duty with your team. I think he's going to bounce around the league and just keep playing.
He is.
But he's excellent. He just can't stay healthy at this point.
The reason I say I would do that trade is because they made the investment to raise the ceiling in a team that is still young.
Yeah.
All in their prime. Brunson, Hart. Now, Hart plays a game where he's going to deteriorate because of the way that he plays. He plays a physical game. Karl-Anthony Towns still fairly young. Mikal Bridges still fairly young. Like, they can lock into this team, into this core, if they choose to keep them. Now the challenge is the tweaks around them to build on that depth. Hope that your draft picks improve. Hope that when you get the vet minimum contracts or the mid-level exception contracts, that you can strike gold and really balance your roster, because that's what these top-heavy teams are having challenges with right now.
Yeah, that's the challenge of the new CBA.
It's the challenge of the new CBA.
That's why, like, they have this window for a few years where Jalen's not making crazy amount of money. Obviously, Cat is, OG sort of is, but Mikal isn't. And they got a hit over the next few years. So what's their window in terms of years, in your opinion?
I'll say three.
Yeah, I agree with that.
3 years.
A three-year window.
3 years. Within that time, you may have a new coach. Maybe they go get Jay Wright to finish the job. That's everybody's thing. You know, when everybody wants,
because it makes too much sense.
It makes too much sense. Go get Jay Wright. You know, call Johnny Bryan or something like that. I mean, that may happen, right? The coach is the easiest domino to fall when you're trying to achieve your goals.
If they lose in the second round, which, let's just face it, is the likeliest scenario. Doesn't mean it's definitely going to happen. It's sports, you never know. But you look at the way things are laying out, it's the likeliest scenario. Do you think we're all going to get calls for Dibs has got to go, and it's going to be basically blaming him? He can't win the big one. Look at his history in Chicago now with the Knicks. You think he's going to be the guy who gets most of the blame?
He gets most of the blame after game 10.
He does. That's true.
Just you tune into Knicks Fan TV after every loss, right?
Yeah.
There's always somebody that's saying, this coach isn't it. He's not our guy. So there's always going to be
I'm not
those
convinced
calls.
He's the guy either, but it doesn't mean I would move on from him. You know what I mean?
You get him to the second round, you put some money in Dolan's coffers, I don't think they're going to make a change. Now, the next year, it puts more pressure on
him. Sure,
the
every year.
Season, every year, there's more pressure.
Every year, there is. It's weird. Like, he's a hell of a coach who deserves a ton of praise. The best coach you've had since Van Gundy.
Absolutely.
I mean, I like Mike Woodson. No disrespect to him. He did a nice job. But, yeah. I mean, Tom Thibodeau has surpassed him. But I do kind of wonder, can you win a championship with him? I mean, you look at his time even in Chicago. You look at his time here. Like, he's had some great regular seasons, but the questions become, can you win the big one with him? And I think that's absolutely a fair question to ask. I just don't know when you pull the trigger on something like that, when you make that kind of major change, because then you got to find someone who you think can put you over the finish line. And I'm sorry, I love Jay Wright. Are we convinced Jay Wright can do that? Did it in college. Yeah. He's going to do it in the NBA?
It's an incredibly, that's one of the hardest parts, including rounding out the team. But it's a valid question. Like, when you look at other coaches, like even a Mazzulla or a Spoelstra, their ability to adapt, their ability to adjust in-game, and adjustments and adaptability also relies on your players. You need the players with the IQ and the ability to adapt and to fly. But those guys can change the tone of a game, and it's not really clear if Tibbs can do that. He's a very rigid coach. He has a game plan.
Yeah.
He always keeps his guys prepared, but can he switch things up in a dogfight against Boston in a 7-game series to give his team an advantage? I think that's where he's going to be questioned.
Who of these, assume you're the three, Detroit, Orlando, could still be Milwaukee, I guess. Yeah. Which team would give you the most nerves in a first-round series?
Orlando's tough because defensively they play a physical brand of basketball.
Yeah.
They can't match the Knicks from a firepower standpoint, even though Paolo and Franz and those guys, they're going to be good. They're on the rise. They still need another scoring point guard to, I think, put them over the top. But where they can give the Knicks problems, and where they have given the Knicks problems over the last 2 years, is their ability to, one, match the Knicks in size. They can rebound well, and they play great defense under Jamal Mosley.
They were dealing with such injuries earlier in the season, and they're sitting two games under .500, which is kind of surprising. All right, CP. We appreciate it, my man.
My guys.
Thank you very much.
Take care, man.
CP, the franchise. You can watch YouTube after Knicks wins or losses.
And a big weekend. Cavs-Celtics form.
And speaking of the Cavs, the number one watch party for the fans by the fans is back.
Nice.
Yes.
Oh, good.
You guys would like to come.
All right. When is that?
You come this Friday. This Friday at 5:30, Slate NY.
You don't want me there.
If you bring your shirt, you can go. I gave that to you as an opening act there to come to the watch party. Right. You got a little Papa Shot, a little pool table.
Papa Shot?
Yeah, a little.
I'm a legend at Papa Shot. Yeah. I don't know if you know this. Like, I beat anybody. I know I don't look very athletic, and I'm not, but in Papa Shot, I dominate. I beat Tiki Barber. I doubled his score. We played Papa Shot. I doubled his score.
He's a football guy, though.
So by beating Tiki, he proclaims he beats anybody.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Hey, it's Tiki Barber. He's a former professional athlete. How many former professional athletes have you beaten in Papa Shot?
Nobody.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. On a Friday here in New York City, Evan and Tiki on the Fan, and joining us right now, let's warm up a few degrees and talk to the manager of the New York Mets, who gets set to play their first spring training game tomorrow. I cannot wait. Tiki can't wait. Tiki's scoring the game, he told me. He's so excited. Right?
I am not going to score that game.
Oh, that was me.
That's
I'm going to score the game. And here's the manager of that baseball team, the manager of the New York Mets, Carlos Mendoza. Mendy, Tiki and Evan, how are you?
How you doing, guys? What's up, Evan? Tiki.
We're good.
You got me laughing here. You going to keep track of that game tomorrow?
Oh, you do. Let me tell you something.
How many substitutions in the first two innings?
Yeah, give me a heads up so I get my hand ready for all the writing I'm going to do.
I'll take it easy on you and be ready, fourth inning.
All right, fourth inning, I'll be ready to go. I am curious, as someone with experience, so much experience growing up in the Yankee organization, what is your opinion on their big announcement today that they are changing their facial hair policy?
Good for them. That was my first reaction. Looks like this was something that they felt like they needed to do, and you got to give them credit. You know, respect that decision. That again, it's I guess what we're living on right now. So they're willing to make adjustments, and they made that decision, and respect that.
Did you ever get a vibe as a bench coach, maybe talking to players, maybe they feel they could be more honest with you, that they didn't like it? Like, were players ever complaining to you about that policy?
Well, they know what they signed up for. You know, from day one, you set the tone, and they know that's part of what they do. So, and then they police themselves. As a former coach, where I was in the minor leagues, and then at the big league level, I didn't find myself having issues with it. You know, it was a simple signal. If, you know, you thought somebody had it, was going over the line, but nothing crazy. So I didn't have bad experience with it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, now that you are your manager and you did a heck of a job last year, we talked about this a lot of times throughout the season, you should have been in the running for, and you were, for manager of the year, and we thought you should have won it, but that's neither here nor there.
Thank you.
The question is, when you think about imposing rules like that, not necessarily beard policy, but just kind of any rules, don't do this, don't do that, what is your philosophy on it? And how do the players react to restrictions, so to speak?
Yeah, I'm not a rules guy. For me, it's just standards. You know, you set the standards and the expectations, and there's, you know, a way of doing things, whether it's how you represent yourself, how you represent the team, the organization, how you go about your business, how you play the game. So there's a level of expectations and standards that you set by actions. And if you start telling guys, hey, don't do this, don't do that, like, they're grown men here, you know? Like, and if we got issues, we're going to address that face-to-face internally. I got a really good leadership group that from the players' side of things, the coaches. We're not afraid to call each other out, but again, it's expectations and high standards. So that's how I go about our business here.
You talk about leadership. Obviously, one guy who has emerged as a captain of sorts is Francisco Lindor. Have you, David Stearns, and Steve Cohen had any conversations about making that official and naming Francisco Lindor a captain of the New York Mets?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I've had some conversations with David. I haven't had any of those with Steve. Not sure if David's had conversations with Steve, but me and David talk about it. And we will continue to have those conversations. But look, he's already doing everything that a captain does, you know, with the way he goes about his business, his actions, everything that he does off the field, not to mention what he does on the field, but pushing guys, holding guys accountable, keeping it loose, keeping it fun. But when it's go time, you know, keeping it consistent. So that's what you want to see out of all of your players. And the fact that Francisco's right there at the top, but you got some other guys that they're willing to do whatever it takes, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
For me, he doesn't have the C on it, but he's doing a lot of the things that a captain will do.
Yeah, and he's even said, like, it wouldn't change his job at all. Do you see, though, that something being official before this season starts, or even during this season, him officially being that captain?
I don't know. For me, as I'm sitting here talking to you guys, again, this was maybe like an informal conversation with David during the off season. Then a week before we reported here, he came up again, but nothing formal, you know. So I don't know.
Well, having been in an organization that championed that in a sense with Jeter, as you know, and obviously Aaron Judge getting it right after he signed his contract, what does that mean? From you, from a fan standpoint and a media standpoint, we can talk about what the C means, but what did it mean for you as a manager having that bestowed upon one of your better players?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just more for you guys and for the fan base. For me, it's just
right.
For me, it's the same because he's just that, you right. know, like without the seat on his chest. So. Like for me, nothing changes, to be honest with you. If there's something that it needs to be addressed, it's not only through Francisco, but he's a part of that conversation among the group from the player side of things. And again, I think it's just his actions speak for themselves, you know?
Right.
So as a manager, it doesn't change much, and I don't see it any different. All right. Honest with you.
So this is your first couple of days of having, obviously, the, I want to know, we haven't mentioned Juan Soto's name yet, but obviously it's the one of the biggest free agent signings in Major League Baseball history. And we're talking about Francisco Lindor, and Evan and I got in a mini fight about a week ago because he was trying to marginalize Francisco
Lindor. I was not doing that. Don't say that in front of the manager.
In light of Juan Soto signing.
Come on.
I just like creating controversy.
I said Soto is better. That's all I said.
He's not better. Lindor is the captain. But anyways, what has it been like adding Juan Soto into this clubhouse? Forget what's going to happen on the field. But, I mean, what has it been like in the clubhouse with Juan Soto now there?
Oh, it's been great. And I think it's happening, developing a lot faster than I was anticipating it, to be honest with you. You know, it takes time. For this guy, he's been in a lot of different teams, and, you know, he's making that huge transition. Coming from the Yankees, now he's here with us, and he's going to be here for a long, long time, as we all know. You know, my first conversation with him was just be yourself. And to give him credit, he was like, hey, man, like, I'm trying to fit in. And he's human, you know, like, people have to realize that these guys, they're humans, man, and they got feelings. And he's an adjustment. But what I'm seeing the past few days here is a guy that is very comfortable, is having fun. The connections, those relationships that you could see developing here in the locker room, in the cafeteria when we're having breakfast, lunch, during our meetings. This is a guy that as the days go by, he's getting comfortable, man. And it's good to see, you know, you watch him and he's smiling, he's, you know, making jokes with his teammates and he's competing out there. He's asking the right questions. So I'm encouraged, to be honest with you, because I thought it was going to take a lot more time. And we still got a few weeks here before we have to break camp. But what a great guy. And just watching him go about his business, his routine, his preparation, like, he's like, oh, wow, this guy's neat. So.
We are talking to the manager of the New York Mets, Carlos Mendoza. So one of the fun things you get to do is make a lineup with all these names in it. And obviously that's been great sports talk radio fodder. This guy should hit here. This guy should hit there. How much do you consider where the guy prefers to hit, like Juan Soto, when deciding ultimately what that opening day starting lineup looks like?
Man, like, this is the lineup conversation. It's like every day. I think I got to throw it back at you. Like, what would you like to see?
Well, I'm going to tell you something, Mendy.
Look,
Mendy, he did this like 3 weeks ago.
I did it 3 weeks. I have an idea that everybody hates. So you have a chance as the manager of the Mets to confirm most Met fans' agreement that my idea is terrible. And you can say, Evan, thank you.
What's
but no,
idea?
I'm going to tell you right now. And then you could kill it. I'll never talk about it again. If you just tell me, Evan, I'm not even considering it. I really am intrigued by Pete Alonso batting second and Juan Soto protecting him in that three hole. Lindor, Alonso, and Soto. Have you given that any thought?
Nope.
They're
come
right.
On, man.
So what are you considering? Go ahead.
I mean, it's 162 plus, hopefully, right? That's the goal. And who knows? But as I'm sitting here and I've been playing around a lot of different lineups and how you envision it. And Pete's between Lindor and Soto. I don't think I wrote that lineup yet.
Well, when you do, you can call it the Evan Roberts lineup.
He's not going to do it. I can tell him. Yeah.
But you know, I guess refreshing is the word. Was it to get Pete back? Because there was so much uncertainty around that. And was there ever a moment where you thought it wasn't going to happen?
Well, I mean, you never know what's going to happen. You know, he's out there. You know, he earned the right to go out and test the market. And we didn't know, to be honest with you. Yeah, we wanted him so bad. But, again, and there's so much out there that you don't know what to believe. But as the manager, you know, as long as he was out there available, you know, I was like, we got a chance.
Right.
We got a chance. And that's how I treat it. I try not to drive myself crazy with everything that was going on you know, all the rumors and this and that. Like, I was just waiting for that text or that phone call from David right. the whole time.
Well, you know, so, Mindy, I don't even know the answer to this. Are you allowed to reach out to the to Pete? Or could you have? And if you were,
yeah, and I did. I texted him, I think, right after the New Year's, just checking on him, you know, because, yes, I'm the manager, and I have a relationship with these guys, you know. And I know when they're out there, they're going to make what's the best decision for them and their family. So I texted with him. He got back to me. And then I kind of, like, respected his space, you know. I didn't want to get too involved with it, but just as a manager, as a friend, how are you doing? How's your family? How's, you know, the off season going, working out, just things like that, but nothing, like, in details with contracts. And are you getting any off? None of that.
No, you didn't throw in, hey, we really want you back.
Yeah, please.
I know they're hardballing you, but we need you back, dude.
Do you notice a difference with Pete Alonso as compared to, because last year he comes in, it's a contract year, a lot of pressure. This year it's sort of a contract year, but he's also making $30 million. Is Pete exactly the same, or do you notice a difference in Pete Alonso as he enters camp?
Well, the difference is in BP. When I'm watching him take batting practice this year, like, he's launching balls.
Right? Really?
But same guy. As far as the personality, same guy. Same personality, smiling, saying hi to people, having fun, working really hard, talking about winning, and that's who Pete Alonso is. You know, he step in the office first day here, and it's like, I'm ready to go, Skip. I'm like, same guy, you know.
Right, nice. That's what we want to hear.
All right. Did you feel like he was playing tight last year? I know we speculated about it, but did you
not
feel
at
like
all? No, not at all. I mean, this guy knows what it takes to play New York, man. Mm-hmm. And he's going on in a year that he's going to be a free agent. But look, I had front row seat when I was with the Yankees with Aaron Judge, and he was going to his free agent year. And I had a front row seat with Pete. Pretty similar with the way they went about their business. You know, it was all about winning. It's all about the team. And what can I do today to help the team win a baseball game? And when it was hard for them, you know, they were so consistent. There was never panic. And that's what I saw out of Pete last year. And again, this week, same guy. So
we're talking to Carlos Mendoza. Obviously, Frankie Montas goes down with this injury. You've got Tyler McGill. You've got Griffin Canning. You've got Paul Blackburn. So you have options. Do you expect, or is it possible, that maybe Jose Quintana re-enters this mix? Is there interest in a reunion with Jose Quintana, from your understanding?
Yeah, I know there's a lot of rumors out there. Look, Q was really good for us last year, man. Like, he was a big part of this team, and, you know, he's out there. As far as, like, where we at, that's more for David, to be honest with you. You know, my job is to manage the 67 guys that I got here right now in camp.
Right.
And then, you know, getting with David as we progress here and cut down to 26 and take what we feel is the best 26 guys going to Houston. So for Q, he's out there. So we'll see.
You are going with a six-man rotation. I've heard you say that, as long as Kodai Senga is in the rotation. I've been curious. I've always been curious about this with six-mans. Would you feel, on a given night with a starter, that you would be more comfortable pushing that guy, maybe to throw a few more pitches, knowing they're going to get an extra day of rest? Is that something that you would consider with a guy, knowing, all right, well, he's got that extra day, maybe instead of 98, I'm going to push him to 105, 110. Is that a consideration with a six-man rotation?
Yes and no. I don't know about 105 and 110 in April or May, you know, definitely April, you know, when you got long ways to go, you're playing the long game. But as far as, like, hey, pushing a guy because he's throwing the ball well, when you're watching him, the body language, how the ball's coming out, not just the result that he's getting, is how is the movement, how is the velo, talking to the guys in between innings. So there's a lot that I take into consideration before I'm making these decisions and these final calls. So everything's on the table. You know, that's, you know, I prepare a lot before the game. I have a lot of information with me, but then once the game starts, I'll let it develop, and then I adjust accordingly. And that's part of, you know, getting to know your players and when to push them and when to just pull the trigger. So As far as like the six men, yes, with Senga, but there's also especially like at the beginning of the season where we have 3 days off.
Right.
You know, we're still having those discussions here whether we want to go with six. Do we want to go with like a piggyback type deal with one of the starters? So there's, I mean, we still got so much, you know, we got ways to go
right
before we're making these decisions. So we just got to keep them healthy, which that's the case right now. Yeah, the news from Montas early in camp, you know, a little disappointed, but, you know, we got options, we got good depth, and we just got to keep it that way.
Yeah, the Montas news is disappointing, and I know he's disappointed as well, wanting to make a better first impression. But, you know, given him being out, obviously Kodai Senga didn't pitch a lot last year, really not really at all. You have a reliever converting to a starter in Clay Holmes. How are you feeling about your rotation?
I feel pretty good. Again, Senga is a big part of our rotation. We all saw, I saw it from the other dugout, but when he's healthy, he's an ace, you know, and we got to keep it that way. We were able to bring back Sean Manaea, who was our ace last year. So those two at the top of the rotation. And then, you know, David Peterson was really good and very consistent for us last year. So that's another guy. Clay Holmes, I'm excited about Clay. You know, we know as a reliever, this guy was a two-pitch guy. You know, the sinker, slider, very effective against right-handed hitters. Now he's playing around with the cutter. He's playing around with the changeup. He's pitching tomorrow even, so you're going to be watching.
I'm ready.
I'm looking forward to watching face other hitters, not just our hitters in live BP, and how he's going to use that pitch. Or those pitches, because in order for him to make that transition effectively, he's going to need more than two to get through a lineup at least twice. So he's in a good place physically. The ball's coming out well, so I'm excited about that. And then we got some other options, you know, Griffin Canning, Paul Blackburn, Tyler McGill. So we got depth, and we just got to be creative here as we get closer to opening day.
Now I'm going to knock on wood. I'm going to knock on wood when I ask this question because obviously guys have to stay healthy. But are you ready on February 21st to make it official? And that is Sean Manaea is your opening day starting pitcher. Are you ready to do it, Carlos?
I'm not ready to do that. You just said it. February 21st. I mean, we still got, what, 6-7 weeks? Guys are still building up. Sean threw his live BP yesterday, 2 innings. Was feeling good today. So we got to see him, you know, pitching games. How is he going to bounce back? And like, knock on wood, you know, keep him that way. And then we will have to make some of those decisions. And the opening day starter is one of them.
Am I on the right track with that, though? Because you mentioned ace twice with Senga and Manaea, and you're right. Like 2 years ago, Kodai was tremendous. And obviously last year, Sean really turned into pound for pound, I think, the best pitcher you guys had. So am I right that if all things are equal and everybody's healthy, that Manaea is going to get that slight edge over Senga with that opening day honor?
We'll see, because, I mean, they're in a different program right now. Like, it's too early. Like, once we get, you know, that second week, first 10 days of March, that you start kind of like lining up their outings and, okay, let's start working backward. But so right now, it's just more the live VPs, the ups and downs and things like that. So I would say, you know, within the first 10 days of March, that's when you start thinking, okay, we need to start putting these guys on schedule here and go from there. So, but too early still.
All right, we're real quick about this. This is getting in the weeds, but I'm so curious because I'm analyzing who I think is going to make the whole roster and all that. Do you guys need a backup shortstop? Because I'm looking at that last utility spot, and it could be Brett Beatty, who's not a shortstop, Jared Young, who's not a shortstop, Nick Madrigal's learning shortstop, and obviously Luis Angel Acuña, who can play shortstop. Is it essential in your mind as manager to have a guy that can be a backup shortstop, or would you be comfortable going to opening day without having a guy on this roster, not named Lindor, who's played the position?
Yeah, look, as a manager and for us as an organization, the conversation's been, you know, God forbid something happens to Lindor, you need someone to go out there and play, say, 4 innings, 3 innings. You know, it's a blowout and you want to give Francisco off his feet. You want to make sure you feel comfortable who's playing the last couple of innings of a game, right? That's for me. That for us, that's basically, you know, the conversation. It's can we trust this guy to play and finish to finish a game? Now, if Lindor needs a couple of days, or if, you know, God forbid, he's down for an extensive period of time, that's a different story. Mm-hmm. But we do feel good. We've been mentioning Acuna, Madrigal. Brett Beatty is going to start at third and second. He's getting just work there during batting practice. Not sure we'll see him in games, especially this early. Now, we get to the middle of March, and we want to see him, and he's comfortable, and he's ready to go for a game action. Sure, we could put him out there because he's part of that competition. So to answer that question, someone that at least can give you a few innings, maybe a game if needed, but if he's an extensive absence from Lindor, then you're looking at somebody that can really give you a chance and hold the position.
Yeah. Now Evan likes to get into the weeds, and you know that's a very in the weeds question. But I want to get a little macro with you, Skip. So last season, I talked to Evan every single week about how this evaluation season for the Mets. They're trying to see what they have in positions. Pete Alonso's obviously in a contract year. You were in your rookie season as a manager. Let's just figure out what we have here. You ended up getting to the NLCS, which is, I think, far exceeding anybody's wildest dreams, and it was awesome. What is your expectation going into this season in the first few days of spring training?
My expectations were the same as last year, is to win a championship. Last year, you know, people outside of the locker room, they were, you know, oh, this is a transition. We knew we were good. We knew, and we kept saying it. You know, we feel like we have a team that is going to be able to go out there and compete for a playoff spot, and that's what you want. Mm. And this year is not different. You know, we got Soto, and we got Manaea, we got Pete, and we added some other faces here. And everybody now is talking about the Mets and the expectations and this and that. Embrace it. You know, this is a great opportunity that we got in here. We have a chance to do something special, and that's how I see it. My expectation is to win a championship.
I love it.
Love to hear it. Now, it felt like Jose Iglesias and J.D. Martinez were very important to that room. Obviously, J.D. came in kind of middle of April after the signing. Iglesias gets called up in late May. That they were very important in that room. They're both not here. I don't think either one's going to come back. I guess it could happen with Iglesias. Who the heck knows? But do you feel the locker room is different, significantly different, without those leaders in there in J.D. and Jose?
No, I think it's different in a good way because they learned so much from Iglesias and JD last year. Mm. You said it, they were key guys to our success last year as a team, as an organization. When those guys came in, they kind of created that environment along with some of the other guys, but because of the experience, especially a guy like JD who's been in so many different winning teams and know what a winning looks like, feels like. It was important, and everybody learned from that, you know, and you could see it in this early going here in spring training where it's guys are loose, they're having fun, but man, they're working, and they're working the right way. They're working in the details, the fundamentals, bouncing ideas off each other. So those are some of the things that they learned from those two guys. Like I said, they were a big influence on our clubhouse. But now there's different guys in there that learn and are ready to take on that role and teach some of the new faces and some of the new guys that are here for the first time, our standards and how the way we go about our business here.
Right. You have a good combination of vets and some of these younger players like Mark Vientos, et cetera, who are going to step up and become, I think, household names for a lot of years. This is a question more from a fan evaluation of other your competition standpoint. I mean, obviously you guys spent a ton of money with Juan Soto bringing in for $700+ million. But when you look at a team like the Dodgers, who seem to spend indiscriminately, does it feel, I don't know, like there's a bar that you can't reach with them? You know what I mean? Like they're going to go get the best players. They seems like they're signing every single one of these posted Japanese starting pitchers.
Yeah, we're going after the best players too.
Yeah, you definitely are. But can you go after that many? You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I mean, we can be worried about, yes, we're watching. We know what's going on. But we're trying to be the best version of ourselves. You know, we're trying to create something here special, too. It takes time. Look, I mean, the Dodgers got here, and they've been, what, 10, 12 years of consistent playoff appearances and things like that. It takes time, you know, and we're watching, but we're not worried about them. You know, our job is to build a first-class organization that is going to put together a team that is going to compete for championships year after year, and that's our goal, and, you know, that's what we're going for. Yes, good for the Dodgers, but we're the Mets, and we're doing our own thing here.
No, can't wait to watch. Tomorrow is the first game, even if it doesn't count. I got my scorebook ready. I'm ready to roll to watch Clay Holmes get his three ups or whatever we do, and we'll have some fun. Carlos, we appreciate you coming on, and good luck.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks, Tiki.
Thank you, Carlos.
There he is, the manager.
All right, guys.
Thank you, man. The manager of the New York Mets, Carlos Mendoza.